Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, actor and author Stuart J. Zully talks about running the bases at Yankee Stadium on one magical night.
I worked in Yankee Stadium for 40 years. At that time, I had worked there for 25 years, and never did I have an experience like this. This was the night that they won the championship. That night, if your listeners remember, Wade Boggs got on a policeman's horse and rode around the field. I mean, it was so celebratory. It was insane. It was, you know, New Year's Eve times 10. And then here I was with a bunch of cops running around the field.
Today on the show, Stuart J. Zully talks about his life as a vendor in Yankee Stadium for 40 years. Stay close.
Hey, my name is Stuart J. Zully, and you're listening to Story Worthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show of over 10 and a half years, coming up on 11 years in July, or you're a brand new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. I hope you guys enjoyed the show last week with actress Molly Heckerling. What an interesting girl. She told a fabulous story. She told a great story, but more than just her story, we talked about her mom, Amy Heckerling, who, you know, she directed Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and she wrote Clueless, among other things. And Molly Heckerling, her dad was Harold Ramis, who wrote Ghostbusters and starred in Ghostbusters. And anyway, so Molly, what an interesting girl, a tremendous amount of talent packaged up right there. And she's now a comedian and just a great girl. And so go back, you guys, listen to Molly Heckerling last week, but not today, because today I'm talking to another really interesting person. He's an actor and a writer, and his name is Stuart J. Zully. And Stuart, you have done a lot of acting.
I have done a lot of acting. It's true. Somehow you sort of, you just keep showing up. And once in a while they say, yeah, let's hire this guy. And the next thing you know, you've been in movies and done The Sopranos and every Law and Order that they keep churning out.
Yeah, I have to tell you, the fact that you were in The Sopranos, just like my mind is like, because, you know, I watch The Sopranos, I'd say all the way through about every 3 years. I have all the DVDs and I just love the show so much. Can you just touch upon that? I mean, I know obviously it was a great time. James Gandolfini was a great guy.
Great guy.
You shot in Queens, right? At the studio, what's it called?
Silver Cup,
yeah.
Right.
And so I know those things because I had on a couple other people from the show, but tell me some more about The Sopranos and just what that feeling was. And even how did you get cast?
Well, I played Tony's accountant.
Right.
And it was actually the only audition I had for The Sopranos. I did a podcast about The Sopranos, and the host of that said that a lot of people audition for a lot of different parts and then they come back for something else. But this was my one thing, and I got to play his accountant. And I did a couple of episodes, and we shot at the racetrack when, you remember when,
yes,
Tony and Ralphie had a horse.
Yes.
Kyle Mai. So we went down to South Jersey, and it was like a road trip, which was great. You know, we were on location down at Monmouth Park, and like you say, Gandolfini was just a class act. And
everybody says that.
Right. And so were the rest of them. Steve Van Zandt. There was one scene I remember. It was just like a group scene. And I was behind Joe Pantoliano.
Yeah.
And Steve Van Zandt, and they both had these crazy wigs on, and I'm standing behind them and I'm looking at a bunch of bobby pins. and they both joked about it. I mean, even Steve Van Zandt, he'd say, you know, because he initially went in for the part of Tony.
Wow.
Yeah. And he said, you know, I'm not an actor. All I do is I just do this, you know. And then they found a spot for him because he just fit in so well.
Oh, yeah.
Van's dance.
Oh, yeah. What a guy. Oh, I'd love to talk to him. And so it's always so funny, too, because I know, like, I can picture that scene perfectly. Mm-hmm. I love the whole Pai Oh Mai, the whole storyline was so great and so dramatic. And you didn't see it coming.
Right.
I mean, it was just so good. But you guys are all standing there, you know, at the track. And it's just like, it really is amazing what actors pull off, because you all looked incredibly serious, incredibly in the moment. Every one of you looked tough, even though you were like the accountant, but right. Everybody looks like a mob guy.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody is so in the scene and so present. And then you're telling me you're standing behind those guys and you see bobby pins.
Yes, exactly. The magic of show business. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny you say that these guys look tough. Some of them were tough. I mean, some of them, one or two of them had been in prison once or twice. Another guy had been a cop for 20 years, so he was tough. Might have even put the guy in prison. And so they were in, they knew that milieu. They sure did.
Wait, and what's the word? What did you say? They knew their what?
Milieu. That's the
M-I-L-L-E-U-I or something?
E-U-R-E. I guess it's French for category. It's the, mm-hmm. The style, the type, mm-hmm. the niche. As it were, Jesus, I'm speaking French. How did you pull this out of me?
I don't know, Stuart.
I did not even know that I did this. Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Now, you have played a lot of tough guys. You've been on Ellen, LA. Wait, what am I trying to say? Law and Order.
You've done a ton of those. Yeah, I've done six Law and Orders. I did Criminal Intent once. I did SVU.
And you were always a detective guy, right?
Mostly. But I was, you know, like on Law and Order, it's always, what do we got? And then they show up somewhere and that's what it is. What do we got?
What do we got?
Well, lady was walking her dog and the dog, you know, and then boom, you know, Jerry Orbach. Jerry Orbach probably said, what do we got? 100 times.
That's so funny. You know,
after the teaser at the beginning, we see it. Yeah, they find it. But
that's so funny. But you've also done all the way back to like Hill Street Blues.
Oh man, Hill Street Blues. Yeah,
I always remember because that took place or was supposed to be in Pittsburgh, where I'm from. But it they didn't shoot there. Maybe they shot some stuff.
No. They shot downtown L.A.
Yeah, of course. And then you've also done some comedies. You know, you did Married with Children back in the day.
Yeah.
And you did the Dana Carvey Show. And you did, you know, Spin City, Becker, all those half hour stuff, too. So what should you prefer? It doesn't matter. You just want to work.
I want to be on the call sheet. That's my goal, you know, and it doesn't really matter. It's funny because Joey, I also co-wrote and co-produced a film, and Joey Pants happened to be in the movie. And So I got to talk to him a little bit then when we did The Sopranos after we had done this film. And he said he'll do anything. You know, he'll take a big part, a small part, whatever it is. And you know out here that you could get two lines on a TV show, and the next thing you know, you're doing six episodes. I mean, suddenly the producer... You never know. So you just show up and you're there. And somebody said it. When it comes to a film, there aren't small parts and big parts. There's short parts and long parts. Like, for instance, I did Wolf with Jack Nicholson. And and there was a day when Nicholson, in a scene that I was in, he was basically an extra. He just came down the steps. And he just kind of looked around, and he was an extra that day. And I had all of the lines that day. Now, it was just short. You know, it was just that day. But that's how it is. You could be the key element of a scene. But then, you know, then at the end of the day, they say, it's time to say goodbye to Stuart J. Zelle. And then
everybody goes, thank you, Stuart.
Thank you, Stuart. It was great. Yeah. But I might have the big, I might have the big thing. Like 2 years ago, I did Vice. Do you remember Vice?
Sure. Mr.
Christian,
sure.
Christian Bale. So my big scene came at the, actually during the credits, and I got into a fight with somebody in a marketing situation, you know, like a telemarketing, not a telemarketing, but, you know, a talk back, and they're, and I got into this fight with this guy. I was playing sort of a conservative right winger, let's say. Mm-hmm. And it was my scene. I mean, it was the two of us and it was the group, but I was a catalyst in that scene for sure. It was fun to do. Adam McKay was great. And that was a perfect example of it. It was just a short role, but a key role. And for that day, I was the big cheese. So
yeah, and you make an impact, and the film, you know, will reflect that. I think that's awesome.
Yeah,
I just rewatched Little Miss Sunshine, mm-hmm. and there's a scene in that where this doctor has to come out and tell the family in the waiting room of a hospital that the grandfather died, right? Mm-hmm. And he has this one line, you know, "I'm sorry he passed" or whatever, and then he turns around. And he says, "I'm going to send the grief counselor or whatever." And then he turns around. He's got one line. Okay. One line. And when he says this, it makes me laugh so hard every time. One line, this actor, I'd love to meet this guy. He just looks down the hall and he goes, "Linda." He's, because you have to, back up. He's counseling the family. He's saying, "I'm so sorry about your grief, and right. I'm going to send a counselor down now. You know, please, you know, anything I can do, let me know."
Right.
Linda!
That spin.
He switches so fast.
Right.
And it's just so funny. And there's a great example. Guy's got one line, nailed it.
Yes, exactly. And that's, yeah.
You've been in the business for all this time. And now, like you said, you're a usual suspect. You know, when they have to call in a tough guy, a detective, a cop, you could even play a killer. You could be a judge. You could be anything, Stuart. Now you're kind of a regular, you know, a regular actor that comes through the casting director's doors. And so parts come to you. You have an agent. You work. You're a working actor. But still, you want to work more. Nobody doesn't, you know?
Right.
But how would somebody in their 40s or 50s who hasn't really, you know, gotten there yet, but still wants to, I guess they just keep plugging away. I mean, in other words, you know, I guess there's just attrition at some point and they pick up new guys, or these casting directors, they stick with guys that they've known in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and now they're going to play the roles of the cops and the detectives as they get older. Mm-hmm. Like, how does that all work? It's just so, it's so nuanced.
It is so nuanced. You know, I think if I were suggesting to somebody who was getting into the business now, even if they were in their 40s or 50s, I'd say, figure out how to put yourself on tape, even if it's a minute, 2 minutes. Then you have the access through IMDb to send that to people and respect their time so your reel isn't too long. And in a minute and a half, they're going to know. They're going to know whether, yeah, we can,
oh, yeah.
You know, they know that. I mean, I've directed theater and I've directed a few films now. You know, when somebody comes in, you're leaning forward or you're leaning back, you know. Mm-hmm. And yeah,
wow.
This is interesting, or now this isn't going to work. You know, how do I get out of this? Yeah. But
a quick 1 minute video is such a great calling card.
Yes.
I mean, you could get a lot accomplished very quickly. You don't need the headshot anymore. You don't need all the credits. Nobody cares what you did in college.
No, it's true. It's true. And if you just keep knocking, I remember years and years ago, I did an industrial film, which is just, you know, like an in-house training film. And the guy that played my boss, he happened to had gone to the same acting school as I did, the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. And I said to him, "You know, in acting school, they taught me how to act, but they didn't teach me how to be an actor. Two different things, you know. And,
wow.
You know, you really have to deal with rejection as an actor because that's what you get hit with all the time. That was great. Thank you. Bye." And you just have to keep going. And I said, "How do I get an agent? I mean, they didn't teach me how to do that. They just I finished my time there, and then they let me go. And he said, this old timer, he said, open the window, take 100 pictures and resumes, and throw them out the window. And one of them is going to stick. And whenever I've taught acting, I grew up in New York, as you could tell.
Yes, I know.
Yes. And I remember almost every day, the local Chinese restaurant would stick the menu in my mailbox and I would throw it out. And then eventually I would look at it and say, I'm in the mood for Chinese food. And there it would be. So it's just, you just keep going.
That's really funny.
Hi, it's me again. And you just keep showing up.
I wonder if that would be an interesting class. Like, okay, like if you were in New York, you know, NYU or wherever anybody goes to school as an acting class to teach, you know, how it's actually going to be, you know, like this is actually what's going to happen. You're going to get called 15 minutes before you're supposed to go to your mother's, you know, a hospital bed, and they're going to tell you, you have an audition in Santa Monica and you're going to need to make a choice and you're going to go to that audition and you're going to show up and there's going to be traffic and you're going to get a parking ticket and you're going to walk in and they're going to say, oh yeah, no, thank you. Right. Like, you just have to be so ready. Like the rejection is so much more than just no. It's more than that. It's the car and the gas money and the makeup and what you're missing out on and what you're not doing because you're trying to get somebody's approval. It's just nasty, isn't it?
It's true. You know, I recently listened to an interview with Lloyd Richards. Lloyd Richards was the director who helped champion August Wilson.
Oh, wow. And he's from Pittsburgh.
He's from Pittsburgh, and he taught – oh, August Wilson.
Yeah.
Right. And Lloyd Richards, he used to run the acting department at Yale for many, many years, and he did so much. And I actually took a class with him, in fact. But anyway, the interviewer said to him, so what would you say to actors coming out now and, you know, et cetera? What's your advice? And he said, learn how to deal with the word no. So just what you're saying. You know, which is you're going to go, you're going to put your face on, you're going to fix your hair, you're going to drive cross town, you're going to curse the traffic on the freeway, and then you're going to get there and they're going to say, oh, that session's closed. You know, we just shut down, you know, and then you can't bring that to the next call that you get next Tuesday because you have to go in there optimistically and positive. I often, when I'm teaching, I use the analogy of sports because I'm into sports. And when a basketball player misses six shots in a row, he says, give me the ball. Give me the ball. I'm going to make the next one. And that's a professional athlete. And that is the attitude that you need to have as an actor. You can go 40 auditions and get nothing, nothing, not even a thank you. And then the next four, you book all four. And only if you have that positive attitude and believe in yourself, you know, you have to truly, truly believe in yourself. I was fortunate to do a couple of episodes of Columbo with the great Peter Falk.
Amazing.
Amazing. And that's what he said. He said, you have to believe in yourself first before someone else is going to believe in you. Because the producer has more riding on your audition than you do because they've got the whole mechanism of the show. They have all this money that's invested in it. And they're sitting there going, can this guy do it? You know, is he believable as the scientist and blah, blah, blah. And for you, after you finish, you just go home and you walk your dog. But he's still got to cast that part. And if they see confidence in you when you step in there, then you're more likely to get a shot, not necessarily get the part, but get the shot. So
I totally agree. They want to cast the part. They want you to work out. They want to put you in the puzzle. They just want it to work out. And so just get in there and make it seem like I'm here. You guess what? You can stop looking almost, you know, right. This is exactly. So exciting because I know exactly what you want. I'm going to do my best. Now, after that casting director gets all these perfect people ready to go, they have to present it to the producers. And then the producers could say, oh, no, we want an Asian woman. Mm-hmm. And then they got to go back to the table. Casting directors must have a very difficult job.
It is a very difficult job. I have a couple of casting director friends, and it's 24/7. And now internationally, she's done a bunch of things over in London. And so the time is all wacky. So before, she would just get calls at 8, 9 o'clock at night. Now she gets called at 3 in the morning.
Horrible. No, but the thing is so it's exciting to, you know, and I've talked to other working actors, and it's just exciting that you have landed a place in your career that, you know, you are a usual suspect. They do call you and you show up. And so it's a win-win. I think it's great. I think you're very fortunate is what I think. But you've worked for it. You've done it.
Yeah, I've worked for it. And, you know, it's funny because even actors who work, most of the time, you're not working. You know, even when you see an actor, you know, you could see, a familiar face, whomever it might be, and they may do 3 movies in a year, but they only work 2 weeks on each movie. So,
or even 9 days total.
Days total. And that's why Joey Pants said he'll take anything. And he works like crazy. I mean, my God, you look him up on IMDb, I'm sure he's got 300 credits. And
that's cool.
But most of the time you're not working. And so how do you fill that time and stay confident? And that's why they say, you know, take classes and stay, you know, keep your instrument tuned and all of that, you know, come up with a new reel. I always say this when I'm teaching, it's like you are the president of your company. You know, you are the CEO, and you have to decide, do I need new pictures? Should I change the font on my resume? you know, even today I was working on my website and moving and shifting things around. It's constantly in flux, you know, and you have to keep doing that. And
I do know, yes.
Yes. Yeah,
this is an art, and it keeps changing and moving. And you change a color, you change a font, you send a tweet, you make a call, you send an email. So it all adds up, and it's like the life you have to live. And the rejection part of it just has to kind of flow through you like water, because it's 90% of the job.
It's more than that. It really is. That's why. That's why Lloyd Richards, he told this story. He said when he was an actor, he booked a job and he was on Broadway for the first time, and he walked over to the theater. Now, his name is Lloyd Richards, and he walks over to the theater. I forgot what the name of the play was. And he looks up on the marquee, and it says starring Floyd Richards.
Oh, no.
His big day. Oh, no. You know, his family's coming in on the weekend or whatever it might be. Starring Floyd Richards.
That's so funny. I talked to somebody once, and I can't remember the name of the person, but they were talking about when they walked to the theater, how excited they were because their name was on the marquee.
Right.
And then after the show, and they change out of their clothes and whatever, and they walk out, and that marquee is already changed.
Oh, that's gone. Yeah, yeah.
God.
I'll tell you, one of the craziest things, I directed a play, a really funny play, and it took place – the two characters were on crosses, and it was and they were right next to Jesus, and it was right. These two guys, one guy ragging on Jesus, and the other guy was very, respectful, and it was a right. Very, very funny play. So we did
You had me at three crosses.
Yeah, it's a very funny one act. I did it in Florida, and then I did it at a festival in New York. Now, often theater companies work out of churches. So the show was in a church, and we won best audience award, best one act or whatever. So then after the show, we went across the street and had some drinks. This is what you do. And by then they had cleared out, just as you say, the marquee is done in front of the church in the garbage were these two crosses that was out. I wish I took that picture. These two crosses in front of this beautiful Gothic church in Manhattan on 46th Street. And I just thought, wow, there's a picture. You know, show's that over. Is. Show's over.
That's 1,000 words.
Easter's over. It's Monday.
So funny. So funny. I could totally see how, though, you booked all these roles as an actor because, you know, you're growing up in this environment and it's just so real and it's so down to earth. So you walk into these auditions and you just be yourself and you're going to fit in.
Well, you know, it's crazy because now I get older. And so I'm going up against bigger name people, you know, people who've been nominated for Emmys or this or that. You know, you go in the room and then you see somebody and you say, geez, I just saw him the other day on Blue Bloods or something like that. And you could start to lose confidence. I do this exercise, which is crossing the threshold, which is we all go to an audition and we have this. I was stuck on the freeway. My kid brought home, you know, a lousy report card, whatever. I got a stain on my pants, whatever it might be. But you've got to go in and be the character. So you cross that threshold and you leave all that crap behind so that you could step into the role. It's just like with you. You have to, you know, step into being, hey, this is Christine and it's story worthy. And you, no matter what mood you might be in.
Oh my God.
No, I'm just saying like that it has to, you've got to be upbeat no matter what's going on in your personal life. And,
I know.
You know, when you listen to a DJ on AM and say, hey, it's 6 o'clock in town. Well, you don't know what happened to that guy. you don't know what his day was. That's right. And he's got to do that because that's what they pay him for. No matter what they, I mean, he could have fought with his wife in the morning and, you know, whatever, the dog bit his kid and he still got to bed at 6 o'clock and we're backed up. Let's go to the weather. And so he's got to cross the threshold and be able to do it. And, you know, when you go to an audition and you see people there and man, he looks right. You know, he looks so much better for this than me. You know, I'm never going to get this. You're not going to get it if you have that self-doubt, you know, like the basketball player who says, give me the ball. You know, it's but we're constantly battling that. I mean, I just did an audition 2 days ago and I looked at it and I said, I screwed it up. You know, I should have done this and I should have done that. It's like it's the ride home sort of syndrome, you know. Where then afterwards, when you're a little separated from it, you're able to have a more objective viewpoint. Do you know what I mean?
I do know. And also, it's like everything you just said. So you have to have all that. All that has to be going on. And you got to throw it away.
Exactly. That's right.
And they'll say, oh, just have fun. Ah, just have fun. You know, and it's like.
Yeah, just be real. Just be real. You know, oh, be real. No, this one's not for me.
Well, listen, I know what guys like you do in your downtime. You write. And that's why you bring forth the topic, running the bases at Yankee Stadium with Stuart Gizelli. So I'm anxious to hear your story. I know you just wrote this book, My Life in Yankee Stadium, 40 Years as a Vendor and Other Tales of Growing Up Somewhat Sane in the Bronx. And so I know this is going to be an amazing story. And so before we get to it, let me just tell everybody that we are still playing Story Smash, the storytelling game show, every Friday night at 7 p.m. Pacific time on Facebook and YouTube. Right now, there's no tickets. You can just come on over. Catch it before we go back to the improv, because then I don't think I'll be doing it on Facebook Live or YouTube anymore. So catch Story Smash. You can head over to storysmashshow.com to get more information. And of course, follow Story Smash on Insta at Story Smash to see all the show action. All right, you guys, he's here right now, Stuart Gizelli. As you know, he is an actor and has been on dozens and dozens of television shows like you heard us talking about. And he does describe his experiences as a vendor in his new book. Now, this is just so fascinating because, you know, people see you on TV. You are like a regular actor. You've been in The Sopranos. We see you. We know who you are. And then you have this whole backstory that you worked in a stadium for over 40 years. And so it's just fascinating. I know you started when you were only 15 years old in the stadium, and I've never met any stadium vendors in my life. So I'm very anxious to hear all the juicy details. And you guys can find Stuart Jazeli's new book, My Life in Yankee Stadium, right now. And I suppose it's everywhere. Where are you pushing it? Where are you pushing it, Stuart?
Well, I am pushing it on my website, stuartjazeli.com.
That's a good one.
Right. And it's at Amazon. It's at Barnes & Noble. It's at Goodreads.
Oh, great. Or you guys go over to skylightbooks.com and always order it from my bookstore, yes. Skylight Books here in Los Angeles. I would always appreciate that. And I can't get over it. You have done over 2,500 events at the stadium, and it just makes me laugh so hard because I know, and I've already read some of the book. I know that it's not just concerts I know it's not just baseball games and sporting events, but you're talking about concerts, and you were there when the Pope was there.
Hey, Rosary Beads here, Rosary Beads.
You cracked me up. You guys find out more about Stuart over on his website, stuartjazeli.com. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Stuart Jazeli.
As we heard, yes, I sold beer. I sold peanuts. I sold even egg rolls back in the day, pizza. And there were a few years where I sold souvenirs in the stands with those big foam fingers that get in everybody's way. And then I also had a souvenir stand. So that would be when you'd be roaming the hallways. And then every so often, periodically, you'd see somebody that had the T-shirts hanging and everything else. And that was me. I may have sold you a shirt. So in 1996, which is 25 years ago, that's when the Yankees started a bit of a championship run. And they won 4 out of 5 championships. That was when Derek Jeter actually was a rookie, I believe, in 1996. And that was Joe Torre and all those great Yankees. And so I had a souvenir stand. Didn't see any of the game, of course. I was so busy that I actually took in that night $23,000.
Oh, my God.
Yes, $23,000 in cash. I talk about that in the book, that over the years I've handled $4 million in cash, which is insane. But anyway, so during the course of the game, I'm wrapping my money in bundles of 1,000, you know, big bulging, but you know, my pockets were bulging, and it was just nonstop. Well, they won that night. That was game 6 of that series against Atlanta. And I finished up about 11:30. And when it's the last game, not only do you have to turn in your money, but you also have to turn in your stock. That's it. You know, whereas if there's a game tomorrow, you just carry over till the next day. And then when the homestand is done, then you do your whole inventory. But because it was the last game, I had to turn in every little T-shirt, every little baseball, every little keychain, all that stuff. And I didn't finish until 3 in the morning, the night that they won that first championship in 1996. So when I left, I was with a buddy of mine. There's a police station in Yankee Stadium, to handle police matters. And I walked by there and I knew some of the cops. They were already having a beer. So they had a keg out. They were celebrating that the Yanks won this championship. So I had a drink with them. And then my buddy and I started to walk through the halls to exit to get to our car at 3 o'clock in the morning. And then we passed this doorway. And I said to my buddy, hey, I think this goes to the dugout. Let's go. So we go down this little hallway and go down some steps, come up some steps, and we are in the Yankee dugout in an empty Yankee stadium, which was incredible.
Now, there's no lights on, or there's lights on? Wait.
A little bit of lights because they started to clean up the seats, you know, so they get some people with brooms and they're cleaning, you know, the maintenance people and stuff. But there was no security. I said in the book, it was like somebody left the keys to Yankee Stadium on the pitcher's mound, you know? And so we went there. And I happened that night to bring a cigar with me. Just in case the Yanks won, I figured I'd have a celebratory cigar. So I started to smoke it in the dugout, right there where Joe Torre and Don Zimmer had sat during this game. So we're sitting there, and then out of the darkness, we see a guy walking towards us, and I'm thinking, as usual, uh-oh, I'm in trouble.
Yeah, right.
That's the first thing you always think, especially when you're doing something you're not supposed to be doing. So Lonnie says, hey, we're sorry, you know, we were just leaving, something like that, great game. This little guy comes out. He's got a drink in his hand, and he goes, some fucking game, huh? It turns out it was George Steinbrenner's ex-chauffeur. I thought it was security, but...
What was he doing?
He was just hanging out, you know. He had his drinks, and he still had one in his hand. So that gave us license to hang out. We started to run the bases.
Oh, my gosh.
And then the cops started to come out onto the field, who had had a few beers, and they're running around and galloping. Everybody was like, we were all 4 years old at Yankee Stadium. So I go back into the dugout, and the phone in the dugout rings. There, you know, and it's hooked up to the bullpen when the manager wants to call out to the bullpen to get somebody warmed up. So again, the phone rings, and I'm thinking, uh-oh, I'm in trouble again, you know. I pick up the phone. I go, hello?
And it's Yankee Stadium.
Yeah. And on the other end, the guy says, do you want the righty or the lefty? And it was a cop out in the bullpen. He was horsing around.
Amazing.
And I said, yeah. And I go, bring in the righty. And then out of the bullpen, some fat cop comes jogging in, pretending to be the relief pitcher. And he comes out onto the field, and he's horsing around. And it was just incredible. I worked in Yankee Stadium for 40 years. At that time, I had worked there for 25 years. And never did I have an experience like this. This was the night that they won the championship. That night, if your listeners remember, Wade Boggs got on a policeman's horse and rode around the field. I mean, it was so celebratory. It was insane. It was, you know, New Year's Eve times 10. And then here I was with a bunch of cops running around the field. It was just, it was special.
It truly sounds like a magical night. Now, did you know some of these cops? Because they were always like, you're a vendor guy.
Yeah. I knew a couple of them, you know, thankfully. It's always good to know a cop.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. And it's so interesting because I'm sure when you're working really hard and you just can't, you know, you're taking money, throwing out the merch, getting the merch out, taking money. You don't have any time to watch the game, to celebrate.
No.
And so you just work as fast as you can, as intensely as you can. And I wonder if you know when you're working like that, do you ever feel inside like, I wish I was out there, or you just feel like, no, this is the money minute. This is when I got to get what I can get.
It is the money minute. You get a little tunnel vision that's why you're there, and you just plow through it. But I tell a story in the book when I had a souvenir stand one time, and Willie Mays was my guy. The other day was his 90th birthday.
Wow.
And Willie Mays was the ultimate. So when they retired Reggie Jackson's number, he asked, and they can ask for somebody to present their uniform to them or to, you know, be there. And he asked for Willie Mays. And so I had my souvenir stand in the upper deck that day, and I heard this on the loudspeaker. And now let's welcome Willie Mays. I ran. I left all my stuff at the stand. I didn't even look for a security guy. Hey, can you watch my stand or anything? Like I do when I have to go to the bathroom. That's what you have to do. But I just went boom. And I just ran, as you said, to get out there to see my hero. And then I went back in, and hopefully I didn't lose too much stuff, you know.
You didn't get to meet him then.
What's that?
You met him or you just saw him?
I just saw him. I met him another time, but I just saw him. And I was just, you know, it's like, it's a magic moment. You know, if you have a favorite actor or actress or, you know, athlete, hero, you know, Michael Jordan or whatever it might be, you just, you know, yeah, and definitely. That's how it was. So I heard the name, the Yankees welcomed Willie Mays, and I just jumped over the barrier at my stand to just get a glimpse of him. You know, I mean,
that's so nice. That's so exciting. So how did you juggle being a vendor in Yankee Stadium and then going on auditions in New York?
Well, usually during the week, there were night games. So I'd have to be at the stadium to check in at about 5 o'clock. Mm-hmm. So if I had some auditions, I would do them during the day and then get up there in time. Or some years, and it varied from year to year, I could make a call and say, I'm going to be late, but I'll be there at 6. Some years that was a no-no. You had to be there at 5 or you didn't work that day. But as I've said, if I didn't show up, like my fellow vendors, they didn't want me to show up because I had seniority and I sold beer and they sold hot dogs, for instance. So if I didn't show up, a hot dog guy might move up to beer that night.
Yeah.
And there's this hierarchy in the stadium of the peanut guy wants to sell hot dogs and the hot dog guy wants to sell beer. And I realized
beer guy wants to sell meth.
But in show business, somebody who's doing commercials wants to do TV and somebody who's on TV wants to do movies. And it's sort of, you know, is it art imitating life or life imitating art? There's always that, the latter. You know, the ladder with the two D's. And in the stadium, I'll tell you, working in Yankee Stadium, you learn about life just because it's happening right there. It was it was great to be there for 40 years. And like I say, 2,500 events. I worked a Muhammad Ali fight. I was there for the Pope. I was there for concerts, Paul McCartney, Madonna, U2, and I started actually when the New York Giant football team were played in Yankee Stadium. That was back in 1970, which is a long time ago. Yeah. And I used to sell hot chocolate, and it would spill all over my pants. You know, it was just the best. But you know, a little kid shuffling around and making a few bucks. And then I just thought, okay, this is a cool job. And the next thing I knew, it was 10 years later and then 20 years later and whatever. I mean, even the year that I co-produced a movie in L.A., I kind of booked out from the stadium for a few months and then I went back. I used to go back and forth between L.A. and New York, and it was a seasonal job, so I could come out to L.A.
Yeah, if you had a shooting job, you just couldn't. You would if you were shooting something, you just wouldn't.
Right.
You would call out.
Right, and then like I say, the hot dog guy might move up. You know.
Yeah. So the beer is the number one seller.
Yeah.
And then what? Coke.
No hot dogs, but you know it's funny you say that about Coke because on a really really hot day, like a 100 degree day, water is better than beer. Because people can just drink so much beer when it's that hot. But people need water. And also with water, you don't need ID. You can sell water to a five-year-old. But with beer, you have to stop and you got to look at the ID and go through all that.
You sound like a pusher. You sound like you're pushing.
Yeah.
And so tell me about the beer guy, because now they have like lids on the beers, right? But like, I want to hear about the guy who's in the back just draft beer. Like that's all he does all night is pour beer. Mm-hmm. Who is that guy and how do I get that job? No, I'm kidding. No, but who is that guy? It must be really crazy.
Well, if they're behind a counter, then they're just pulling the tab and they're pulling draft beer.
But, I know, but I'm talking about who fills up the trays. You go out with how many beers? 24?
24. Well, when I finished, we had plastic bottles of beer.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Back when I started, we did have beer in cups that had a plastic filmy covering on it. So hopefully it wouldn't spill. It tended to spill a little bit. And those came out of kegs in the station, which is where you would get your stuff, whether it be peanuts or whatever.
So who works in the station?
That's the porter. Right.
And whether it's a guy or a girl, and they're back there and just...
They're working. No, they're working hard because they're filling. They have to cup up the trays, put 20 Dixie cups, you know, of 16 ounces into these trays, and then manually slide the tray down, and then a dispenser would pour four at a time, then slide it down four at a time. Then it would go over the, for the plastic, they'd pull a sheet. Then a plastic heating mechanism would put the plastic seal it. Then you'd take the tray, you'd give your name, Zully, beer, and there would be a guy at the door, and then you go out and you sell.
And he checks you out, like, okay, I saw Zully just took out 20.
Right, yeah. So
he's responsible for, what is that? How much money was that? He needs to bring back 150 for that tray. Right,
yeah, something like that. So you would go out. So I would say Zully out on four, paid two, meaning I had already paid for two trays and I'm out on four. So he's keeping track of that. There would be a checker and then there would be a cashier who would count your money. So while the guy was doing the beer and filling your cups, you'd be quickly shoveling the money to this guy, making sure that he counted it right, making sure that he initialed on your card that you did pay, because you don't want to get into a problem at the end of the night. Like, hey, wait a second.
Yeah, you can't give out free beer.
You can't give out free beer. No, because it's all accounted for, you know.
And they count by the trays or the cups, the trays.
Right, right.
I don't know why I find that so fascinating.
Well, it's funny that you say that you can't give out free beer because... Well, if you read my book, My Life in Yankee Stadium, you'll see how I managed to work around that a little bit because we had cans some years and I would pour the contents of the can into a cup. But occasionally I wouldn't pour the whole content of the can into the cup. Maybe the head would get high on the cup and there would be a little bit more beer left in the cup, in the can. So when I got down to my last beer or two, I would top off people's cups. They'd take a sip, and then I would take from three of the other empty can, quote unquote, empty cans, and top off their beer. And of course, that might lead them to give me a tip, which is what we used to call a subway. So when you got a tip in Yankee Stadium, like if you gave me $1, I would say Subway. And apparently, back in the day, it was considered a little way for you to help you to get on the subway to go home. So that was synonymous with tip was Subway.
That is so funny. Oh my gosh, Stuart, what a life.
What a life.
Listen, Stuart, thank you so much for coming on the show. You are an amazing person. You've led an incredible life. And thank you for sending me a copy of the book. I'm definitely going to finish it. I find it absolutely fascinating. And boy, what an actor you are. I can't wait to see more of you on the screen. You guys can head over to stuartjzully.com. It's a beautiful website, by the way.
Thank you.
And you get especially the cover, that huge stadium. And when you're telling the story about, you know, running the bases, I'm just picturing that stadium around you. Must have been just stunning.
It was amazing.
A beautiful memory. Wonderful memory. You guys pick up his book, My Life in Yankee Stadium, 40 Years as a Vendor and Other Tales of Growing Up Somewhat Sane in the Bronx. Thanks so much, Stuart. I really appreciate having you on.
Thank you, Christine. This was a lot of fun.
All right, you guys, on behalf of Stuart J. Zully, my name is Christine Blackburn saying, make it a story worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Story Worthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.